Good afternoon. What I want to do today, or this afternoon, is to bring together some of the things that we discussed earlier this week, and also feed into what Lynette was talking about this morning, particularly about mental formations, wholesome and unwholesome. And what I really want to do is I want to talk about the need for developing the cauldron that we can actually live an ethical life, one that's kind to ourselves so that we won't, in the main, be kind to others. And so the first thing that you recognize from when I talked about five skillful habits is that if you're going to actually be able to take the time or even feel like you have the freedom to connect to living ethically with yourself, there has to be some background of resilience. You have to feel that there's a space in your life for doing that. And so that we have a model for that, which typically we have a slideshow, and then we got rid of the slides, and then we had some handouts, and we got rid of the handouts, so I'm just going to get you to imagine it. So ultimately, if you want to think about resilience, you can recognize that for all of us, there's a window of resilience. You can picture that as two parallel lines. So it's been called the zone of resilience. It's been called the zone where the thinking brain is online. It's been called a number of things, but really what it is that place where if you're living in it, you're functioning effectively. You're doing okay. So you can imagine, if you were to look at both your work and home life, that there could be a line that essentially when you wake up in the morning, you can feel yourself really having to gear to get up. And that's the time when you often use some of the most energy, is just getting out of bed. I don't know what it's like for you, but that's what it's like for me. And typically I try, it takes two or three attempts before I can actually get out, but that's another matter. So we're getting out of bed. We sort of connect with the day, have our breakfast, begin to go to work, and perhaps during the time when we're actually relaxing or connecting on the way to work, if we're not thinking about being at work before we're there, we can sort of slow down a bit. The body down regulates, if you will. And what you've done is you've really connected to two parts of what's referred to as the autonomic nervous system. The names don't matter, but if you want to refer to it elsewhere, this is what it's going to be, the autonomic nervous system. And the first part of it is that it was activated when you got out of bed, and that's the sympathetic nervous system. And it gave you the energy, it turned on the systems that allowed you to actually become active. The parasympathetic nervous system is when you begin to sort of downregulate and begin to feel a bit more relaxed. And so throughout the day, you'll find that, for instance, if you've got some hard work to do, that you'll spend some time really, really thinking about it, maybe even worrying about it, sympathetic nervous system comes on. Finish it, have a few moments, go chat with a colleague, parasympathetic comes on. So you're constantly upregulating, downregulating, upregulating, downregulating, and if things are going well, within that zone of tolerance, zone of resilience, where the thinking brain is online. And it's at that time when you feel like you have the most mental clarity, and it's that time when you feel like you've got the energy to think about something like living more ethically. Now, I don't know about you, but my day rarely goes like that. So when I get to work and I've overbooked and I've got two patients sitting in the waiting room and I've got to decide what to do, my sympathetic nervous system goes, whoa, and I pop out of that zone. Now I can do that a few times. I get it all resolved, everybody's happy, it worked out anyway, I'm back down, I'm connecting, it feels really great. And then something else happens that's out of the ordinary that pushes me up again. So if you think about it, I'm constantly moving in and out of that resilience zone, and I essentially on average, if you think about it, are staying kind of in the middle of it. That's what we really call homeostasis. That's really when everything is working well. We're coming back to homeostasis. We're always coming back to the neutral. We're moving out. And so when I get home, I've got the energy to think about what I'm going to do. I've got time to consider and the energy to consider getting the exercise I need so that I can actually feel better the next day when I go to work. And that, for many of us, is a bit of a fiction. Okay? What happens, of course, is that we pop out of that resilient zone over and over again. The boss comes by and seems angry, and even though the boss doesn't speak, I begin to say what's wrong. Even though nothing's been said, I'm going to think the worst. And all of a sudden, I'm popped out again, and I can't reset until I go get myself a cup of coffee and really sit down just for a moment with myself, but I'm actually working while I'm sitting down for that moment so that I don't really relax. And so I sometimes are always moving in and out of that zone. So by the time I get home, because I've always been out of that zone, I don't have anything left. And so I come in and my good sense says, everything I know says, if you just go out and go for a walk, you'd feel better. And of course, do I do that? You can raise your hands for the ones you think I did. So of course I don't.
Oh, Jeff.
So of course I didn't. Okay? Because even though I know that that's the thing to do, I can't find the energy, remember that emotional exhaustion, I can't find the energy to actually do that. And thus what happens is I get into a cycle. I haven't done the things at home that actually allow me to return to work and have the energy to enjoy engaging with it. Then it becomes a burden. I don't really feel like I want to be there. I do, by the way, because I know all this stuff. I don't want to feel like, don't you go home telling everybody he doesn't want to be in his office. So I don't want to feel like I want to be there. And then everything begins to pile up. The work, when it comes, seems like more of an emergency. And what happens then is the mental formations, the thoughts, have moved into a space where they're constantly negative. They're always looking for the dark. I can't see the positive. So what you have to recognize is that I have to be in a particular, not frame of mind, but a particular way of being, so that my frame of mind is consistent with living well and adopting an ethical stance to myself. Now sometimes we say, well, that happens sometimes, and then we get over it and we recover and do. But more and more, that tends to be, it may not be for all of you, but it tends to be for many of us, many of you, the way our work and family life is. Okay? Now here's, well, there are some problems with that, but here's one of the major problems. Once we start coming out of that resilience zone frequently, we move from something called homeostasis to something called allostasis. And allostasis is that space that I get to when I'm in survival mode. It's that area, it's how the system starts working in order, because I now feel, even though there are no saber-toothed tigers out there, even though nothing is probably actually going to do me any physical harm, my body is responding as if there was a saber-toothed tiger just around the corner and a band of headhunters are right at the door. allostasis. Now, when allostasis continues for an extended period of time, it develops almost a permanence. So that actually it sits up there, and that's my go-to. Then what occurs is I lose my ability to reset to homeostasis, and things start breaking down. Physically, psychologically, of course. Now, one of the things that the breath does, which is kind of a side benefit and a very useful one, is it to some extent artificially brings us out of allostasis and brings us back to homeostasis because of a system that Annette actually mentioned briefly before, the vagal system. So the vagal system is part of the parasympathetic nervous system, and what it does is it puts a cap on the heart rate, which if you remember about my surgery example, that's what I did. I put a cap on my heart rate. So I can use the breath that you've been learning to do throughout the day to essentially put a cap on my heart rate, on your heart rate, so that it is not going to be quite as damaging, but that can only last for so long. But just as a matter of interest, Stephen Porges, who's written a book called The Polyvagal Theory, talks about this in his research. He himself says the book is unreadable. So if you're going to go look for Stephen Porges, go look for his websites and go look for his online talks. They're much better. Short aside, I look at my time. I've got the time to tell you. So what happened is that everybody in Germany wanted his work, and so what he did is all his papers were sent to Germany, translated into a book. Then the Americans said, well, if you've got it in Germany, we don't have it here, we must have it here. So they translated the German back into English. Doesn't work very well. So in any event, what we know is that it's really the breath, but also it's the aspiration. It's the actual out-breath that puts a cap on the heart rate, which is why you notice periodically when you're very tense, what you do is you do, and what you're doing is you're actually engaging the parasympathetic nervous system through the vagal system, and you're putting a cap on the heart rate. Now, what happens, of course, and I just said it, is as soon as all of this has got you in survival mode, you move into a different way of being. And that, as psychologist Darcy Narvaez indicates, you then become, you're developing the ethics of survival, which is very different than the ethics we're talking about. And the ethics of survival typically are every person for themselves as opposed to community. So when you're in survival mode, you're beginning to act in ways that are not consistent with your well-being or the community's well-being. And the problem is, and this is really important, is when you're in survival mode, when you're really up there at that edge in survival, you're not in charge. So there are four things, that you're prone to do when you're in survival mode. We all know what they are. They're fairly well known. Fight, flight, freeze, and a fourth one that's not as well known is tend and befriend. Okay? So when you're in survival mode, what you're doing is that you're actually moving across all four of those ways of being automatically and out of your control. It's always important to remember, once you're in survival mode, primitive brain's in charge, and that small little cognitive structure that Lynette said was about 2 inches, well, it's kind of bypassed. Actually, what occurs, again, a bit of interesting physiology, some researchers at SickKids in Toronto noted, we used to think that when you got in survival mode, that the cognitive system cut off from the limbic system, which is where all this intensity is coming from. But now what we know is that the limbic system floods the cognitive system with emotional and high emotional distress. So you can't think straight, if you will. Now, some of us have been there. We've all been there to some extent. Some, in certain circumstances, have been there and been right in the middle of it. And so the breath, when we use it at that stage, has limited usefulness. Limited usefulness. You want to keep that in mind. Once you're there, as the psychologist Jonathan Haidt said in his book called The Happiness Hypothesis, you're like a small child riding on an elephant, thinking you're in charge. That's until the elephant decides it's going to run away. And then you only have a few choices. You can jump, and that's going to hurt. Fight. You can beat on the elephant, and what good is that going to do you? You can freeze and hang on and just wait. But there's really not much else you can do until it runs its course. So as that actually comes out in your behavior, if you happen to be in survival mode, then you find that you're irritable. You're going to be reactive to things. If it's flight, you might even find yourself just isolated, feeling depressed, not being able to connect at all. If it's freeze, you can't make a decision. When I used to do marital therapy, the worst fight was always the what's for dinner fight. And the what's for dinner fight was because once you've made the decision, cooking is easy. But at the end of the day, trying to make that decision is overwhelming. It just takes too much mental energy. The what's for dinner fight. Freeze. And then the fourth one tend to befriend. Instead of being assertive and taking a stand, you placate and try to make everything okay. Because these survival systems are so deeply ingrained in our brain and are so prominent in the way we engage with life, as we've said over and over again, the brain and the body is a survival detection system. Only recently has it become a thoughtful system. So just keeping that in mind. So what we recognize and what we've been talking about is that once you're there, you may as well just wait it out. It's not pleasant, but it will end. You do know that already. Where mindfulness comes in is when you begin to detect that system because you're paying attention to the ongoing flow of things. Not because you're using the breath to control your emotional state, but because you're using your breath to see where you are. It's not attention, it's awareness. So as anger, when anger emerges, or fight emerges, it's gone from needing to assert yourself, perhaps speaking to someone about it, things that I have to do that are actionable, and if I don't do, lead to that anger. So somewhere up that path, there's a moment when you know, I better do something now, or I'm going to be here. Okay? The same thing with flight. When I'm running out the door, and I have no control, down, if you look at the silos, down that silo, is the sense that I need to step away from this, because it's getting too much. The ability to step away before you run away. Always when you're in charge. When you are thinking about freezing and you really can't do anything, it's the moment further down that silo when you say, I don't have enough information. That's right, that's what freezing is. freezing is. I don't know enough. I don't have enough information. And so it's that ability to say to someone, I'll have to go check this out. Instead of feeling like you've got to say something in the moment because you feel under pressure. Tend to befriend, if I go down the silo, is essentially being able to connect to something and really feel like I am promoting well-being in others as opposed to placating because I don't want somebody upset. So all of these have healthy behaviors associated with them, and what you're doing is that you're clicking right in the middle of it as each is beginning to build, or they may all build together, and saying, I need to do something different. When I'm still in charge. And so, when you're beginning to use the breath as a means for anchoring you, you're beginning to use the breath in a way that connects you with what you need. Instead of waiting until something else takes over and it's screaming about what you need and you have no control over it. And so that's what mindfulness is. That's what paying attention is. It's being able to look, be aware of the changes, and act, if you will, in that wholesome way. The mental formation. And that wholesome way. If the thought comes up, this is not working, instead of it's going to be okay, the wholesome, the beneficial, the skillful, let's engage while I'm in charge. Now, it doesn't always turn out perfectly. Some organizations, whatever, it's not going to turn out perfectly. But you know that you've had a chance to say. And you're recording in your own hard drive, what are the issues here? Everybody knows that while the economy is supposedly booming, really popping back and forth across jobs is really not the thing that one does anymore. So there's always a bit of fear associated with it. But even if there's fear associated with it, there's a sense that if I don't do this, I'm going to be here. So it's not kidding yourself about what's going to happen. And it's knowing how to do it. Okay? So it's really important to know then that what we're doing with the skillful habits is we're connecting with ourselves in a way, ethically, as we're really connecting with what we know we need so that we can actually regenerate. So we can actually stay in that place where we have the potential for living a full life. Now, is that easy to do? Of course not. Does it take practice? Of course it does. And I want you to think about the importance of practice. So let's just take that model and say, that's the survival model. This is how you engage with it. This is how mindfulness helps. And what you're doing is recognizing you're staying in that zone of resilience, and you're in many ways benefiting your health. So let's assume that you've been able to actually develop these skills over time, that you practice so that when you begin to feel any of these things emerging, you engage effectively and competently, and then you're comfortable with the outcome. Whether or not someone says yes or no, you've said this is what the problem is. And so in the main, you're able to stay in that zone of resilience. And therefore, it should be easy to practice an ethical way of being with yourself. Well, not so much. So, what we know in psychology, that for and in neurobiology, so and for a long, long time, is that we are very good at fooling ourselves and not seeing reality. So let me take you back to a recent book, not back to a recent book, but let me take you to a recent book called Behave by a neurobiologist, a neurophysiologist actually. Robert Sapolsky. And what he says in the book is this, and he gives all kinds of research that if you're in psychology or if you've worked around the area for a while, you already know, which is we tend to see things in ways that aren't real. We tend not to really see the reality around us. We have all kinds of ideas of perception. We connect with thoughts in a particular way. Our brain is wired to be efficient, as I said before, but not effective. So sometimes what we really have to think about is that we actually don't know if what we're seeing is what's happening. Take the example of the boss who seems to walk by angrily and doesn't look at us. Most of us in here, even if we're calm, is going to say, what did I do? Because ultimately, we're wired to see, and nothing's going to change that, we're wired to see things as not working out very well. We're wired to see things as dangerous. So when we're looking at that boss and we're saying to ourselves, what did I do? We're not even considering those other possibilities. Could be mad at somebody else, could be preoccupied, could be just whatever, who knows. So there are all kinds of possibilities, but almost everybody picks the one that is the worst possibility. And we're all wired to do that. So it's not something that you're doing wrong, it's just something that you did. So the ability to see things clearly is very, very hard. Now, Sapolsky, who is a staunch, if you will, scientist and has no truck with free will, says we're all wired to do it and we are conditioned to do it. And we're conditioned to do it from birth. It's modified by how we grew up, it's confirmed in where we grew up, and it's really, really set in stone by what the behaviors that would go on before it. So he says, live with it. Okay? And that's a real problem for me anyway. I actually heard him speak, and it's kind of interesting. You could tell that he actually believes it because he came dressed perfectly for being a Stanford neuroscientist. He had a long beard, he was slightly disheveled, his kid was in private school, and he spoke the entire book. If he got 500 pages of depressing prose written very well. In a slideshow that lasted an hour and a half, he covered every chapter quickly. So this is a fellow who simply lives his behavioral belief. I am conditioned to do this. I'm going to dress like I'm conditioned to do this. This is who I am. Now, thankfully, he's not the only game in town. So the next person we talked about, remember Kahneman, Daniel Kahneman, who said in this, and he's a lot more succinct than Sapolsky, he says it's system one, and that's the automatic system. System two is the system that we really have to work at, get into. So in this automatic system is all the stuff we've done before that pushes us to act consistent with that, no matter if what's in front of us is different. And what he says is, he gives us a bit more hope, it takes a lot of energy to stop, pay attention, and see the possibilities. That needs 50 years of research. It's confirmed that time after time. So he gives us a sense that, yes, we can, but it's going to take work. Now, that's true. It's going to take work. We can see different things, but it's going to take work. And then comes a real glimmer of hope, and that's Darcia Narvaez, anyway, N-A-R-V-E-A-Z. And what she does is she gives us the neurobiology of moral development. And interestingly enough, she introduces us to mindfulness. And what she says is this, is I can learn to be ethical. It doesn't come just out of the blue. I can learn to be ethical if I practice it. And she connects mind, and she sees this as coming from childhood. But truthfully, there's no reason we can't all learn, and she's not cutting us out just because we're a little bit older. But she uses mindfulness. There's a sense of how we connect so that we actually bring it into procedural memory. Procedural memory is really important here because it's my go-to, if it's in memory, when I'm faced with a situation. So when we're talking about ethics and mindfulness, and particularly the five skillful habits, it's those practices of respect for mortality, generosity, boundaries, skillful speech, mindful consumption. It's the practice of it that embeds it in procedural memory that we come back to. It's the practice of it that embeds it in procedural memory that we come back to. Just because we know what it looks like, insight is highly overrated. Just because we know what it looks like, if we don't practice it, we don't put it into memory so we have access to it. So what you're doing is you're recognizing my mindful practice is not just practicing saying the following the breath, it's practicing paying attention to what I'm doing when I'm following the breath. It's being fully aware and taking it into procedural memory, if you will, as I'm doing it, so that under pressure, I come to it. So, an RCMP fellow in Regina is the place for people who aren't from Canada, Regina is the place where the Royal Canadian Mounted Police train. So, the RCMP person who was head of the SWAT team said something very profound. He said, you never, never rise to the occasion. You always fall back on your training. You never rise to the occasion, you always fall back on your training. Under pressure, you lose the ability to access it if you haven't learned it. So it's that real sense of practicing this, practicing it diligently, that allows us to connect. Now, that's not going to happen overnight, and you won't have it by the end of this course. Okay? I'm sorry. However, we've given you, and we are giving you, and this is important, the scaffolding to be able to do it. Now comes the really good news. I have to keep going back. I'm going to try to do it without having to go back to my iPad, and I'm reading the book, and I cannot remember the woman's name. Anyway, there's another neuroscientist named Wilma Carstel. That's it. Now, what's interesting about Wilma Carstel is that she's a brilliant woman, but she writes for scientists, and Sapolsky is a brilliant guy, but he writes for, well, I can't see a 500-page book and basically talking about brain and behavior as being for the layperson, but he writes it in a way that we can engage in it and actually read it because he's a fairly humorous writer. So he gets more legs than she does, but she's got a great idea. And her idea is this. And again, she brings mindfulness into the package. She says, what we do is that if we practice, is that we have the ability to connect with patterns of behavior that we access that are sometimes automatic and sometimes cautious and sometimes are things that are really things that we have to think about. But as we're going through things, we choose back and forth between automatic and the stuff that's conscious. And we can do that, she calls it the agile mind. And we can do that if we pay attention, if we allow ourselves to connect, if we practice, so that it flows smoothly as we work through something, it comes out in a way that we feel we have ownership of. We're not surprised by it. And you can think about it. I mean, most of you have spent some time doing something for a long, long time. And you recognize when you actually see something that's associated with what you do, it seems like you know how to do it even if you haven't touched it, if it's related to what you know how to do. So that part that's essentially in Kahneman's system one, it's accessible to you, and you use it and connect to it in a way that's beneficial. So this is what we're doing with five skillful habits and practicing them. And because as Narve, you know, as Darcy says, what we're doing is we're being able to connect to a way of being moral, of being ethical, that manifests in ways that we hadn't thought of, but is right for the situation. Because I've overtrained it. I've connected to it. It's a new situation, and I automatically bring to bear what I know, and it conforms to what I need. So it's not rigid. And that's how an agile mind works. So this is all kind of up in the air and theoretical. So let me give you a real example, a beautiful example. One of our colleagues, Margaret Dupuy, thank you, is a sports psychologist. And sometime during the Vancouver Olympics, or before the Vancouver Olympics, she and a group of colleagues were approached by some members of the Olympic team to see what they could do about training. And what Margaret did is this. She took on the task of learning a brand new set of skills, which we'll refer to as, if some of you are therapists may be familiar with biofeedback, but what she's done is she's combined that with neurofeedback and neurobiofeedback. And what she's been able to do is she's connected the process of neurobiofeedback to the ability of the athlete to be fully present in aerial skiing. Now, I don't know about you, but I've seen them do it, and I wouldn't even be fully present getting close to it. So one of the things that happens is, of course, you get cluttered, and I suspect a touch of anxiety in the top where you're turning, to recognize how you're turning correctly, and you begin to lose focus. So what she did is that she began to train these athletes, the ones who participated, and being able to take the body sensations and relate them to a cognitive state. So she could get them to connect body sensations to a cognitive state, to a mental state. Sorry, not a cognitive state, a mental state. So what they could do is they could be aware of when they were moving out of the zone by having the body, by attuned to the body's sensations once they finished the training, which meant, and this is really, and recognizing they practiced this for a long time, which meant that they connected when they were in the air, being with the body, being in the air, and making sure they stayed in a state where they could stay fully present for where they were, and then landed. She published a couple of papers, but one of the most gratifying things is one of the persons in her training program won Canada's first gold. So ultimately, being able to connect at this level, being able to stay present for that zone that you have of being able to connect is incredibly important. In places like work, where sometimes there may not seem like there are any options, what you're looking for is that one moment when saying no is okay, as opposed to just saying yes automatically because there seems to be no yes. That one moment, because you're currently always present for the possibility. So much of what we're teaching you is to be present for the possibility, not to assume. We're always in the present. This is this, that was that, that's not here anymore. And that will be then, we're not there. Present for what's in the moment. Because it's in the moment when you're going to connect ethically with yourself and with the other. It's being able to draw upon all those skills that you've cultivated to ensure that you move smoothly through things so that you stay in that zone of tolerance. Now, nobody's going to suggest that this is easy or that we all get it right all the time. I personally get it wrong quite frequently. But now, because I'm practicing, and we are practicing, it becomes apparent that I've gotten it wrong. Not that it's a horrible thing that I've done, we all do. And then I say, so what did I learn from that? And what's next? What did I learn from that? And what's next? So there's a possibility, she and I have talked about it, of bringing that particular process to a specific disorder that often is really problematic, which is PTSD, because thoughts and everything overwhelm. You're always in the survival system. And just being able to connect with those moments in time of peace and notice what's in the body may be a possibility of just helping and giving some relief, being able to control what's happening in the body with the breath and a variety of other things. And just staying in a zone where you can be able to connect. We'll see. There's a possibility. Right.